I'm sorry, Fox versus American Alternative Insurance Corporation.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Ratzak.
I'm here on behalf of the
plaintiff appellant in this case, Kevin Fox. This case is before you on an appeal from a 12B6 motion, which dismissed the complaint, with the district court finding that the insurance company, because it was an excess carrier, basically owed no duty whatsoever to inform the insureds, the detectives in this underlying case, of potential or actual conflicts which would have allowed those detectives certain relief on their own.
Now, we have a very, what I consider a very bottom line situation, I suppose. And I would really appreciate your giving me your best argument that the agreement between Mr. Fox and the detectives assigning the claim against AAIC in exchange for a promise not to pursue the punitive damages does not violate public policy in Illinois. Because what I'm worrying about, to put it very bluntly, is that this is an end run around that public policy. So you're going to have to help me out.
That's obviously not something that came up in the briefs, so I'm not in a position to cite cases to you, but I can only tell Your Honor that this is the method by which almost every bad faith case in Illinois comes to fruition before the appellate courts. You have an assignment with the, adverbs or the pronouns doesn't work. If you have a plaintiff in an underlying case and you have a defendant in that case, a tortfeasor, and the tortfeasor believes that the insurance company has done something wrong, has not given the insured all its rights, two things can happen. The insured, in this case, the detectives, could sue the AAIC and say, look, you need to cover us for our punitive. But almost that just doesn't happen. In almost every case that I have ever seen in Illinois insurance history, the insured assigns that right of action, and it's assignable because it's not a personal action. It's based on the breach of the contract to the plaintiff. And then the plaintiff, in turn, the injured person, the tort victim, sues the insurance company in the shoes of the insured. And the result is the same either way. The only difference is that by doing this as part of that process, as in this case, the injured person releases or agrees not to execute against the insured individually. That's the consideration for the assignment. So the bottom line is that the same case goes ahead on appeal as if the insureds had taken it themselves, except that the plaintiffs are doing it. Well, that's the best explanation I can give you, Your Honor.
Here's my problem. The detectives who lost assigned to Mr. Fox their claims against their own insurer. None of the insurance policies at issue cover punitive damage. Illinois public policy prohibits insurance coverage of punitive damages. So what it seems that you're claiming that Mr. Fox is not really seeking recovery of punitive damages. Rather, he's seeking recovery for tortious conduct by the excess insurance company against the insured detectives who assigned those claims to Mr. Fox in exchange for release of the punitive damages against them. So, you know, what is that tortious conduct by the insurance company? Well, Mr. Fox seems to assert that AAIC failed to inform the insured detectives of conflict of interest that was created by, you know, the representation by the same lawyers and between the detectives and the insurance company because of the punitive damages claims. And that, you know, that I don't mean to be making a speech, but I'm trying to clarify in my own head.
What you said, I have no disagreement with, Your Honor. That would be the third point in our brief. It was a point that the district court judge did not rely upon, as the briefs noted. The district court judge went to look to duty, not whether there was a public policy issue about punitive damages being recovered. And our point on that is simply that we're not recovering under the policy. If we had not taken the assignment from the insureds, but instead we pursued the insureds for the punitive damages, which we could do, and put pressure on them, obviously they would in turn have turned around and sued their own insurance company. They would have been forced to get money from them to pay what they were going to owe us for the punitive. And they would have had the right to do that because they're not looking to their insurance company for coverage under the policy. They're looking for the damages that the insurance company caused to them by their conduct.
But can you explain how AAIC's breaches or alleged breaches of its duties caused damages to the detective? I mean, assume for the purposes of that question that AAIC's duties didn't arise until after St. Paul tendered the policy limits to Fox. At that point, how did AAIC's actions contribute to the award of punitive damages against the detectives?
I have to divide that. First, one of our points was that their duty to inform the detectives of the potential conflict existed from the moment the representation began.
Even though the court had done so.
I'm sorry. The court had not done that, Your Honor. I believe it's referring to the discussion in chambers where the district court judge had that exchange with counsel for the detectives hired by St. Paul. We don't know what the detectives knew. We know what the counsel in chambers told the judge, but we don't know if it's true. And that's not something – that's a factual dispute that's going to be resolved once we get to that point. The other part of your Honor's I'm sorry, I need to go back. The other part of Your Honor's question had to do with if we had pursued the insureds and the insureds had in turn sued AAIC. I'm sorry. The other part of Your Honor's question, I have to step back, I think was almost approximate cause instruction. Your Honor asked me what would have happened differently if AAIC hadn't breached. Assuming AIC had a duty to tell these detectives, look, you have a right to your own lawyer, somebody's going to pay for it, not us, and you have a terrible conflict here anyway. Assuming that occurred, Your Honor's looking for approximate cause, but proximate cause, that doesn't deal with duty. It's not an issue that was brought up on the appeal, and I think that's because proximate cause is not part of this equation. Ironically, I only thought about this, frankly, as I was sitting there this morning. In Illinois, we have a rule that the insureds have certain duties. If they breach that duty, then they're liable for the judgment. No case has required the insureds suing their carrier or the plaintiff under an assignment from the insured suing their carrier to prove that things would have come out differently. And although no court has specifically expressed that, the reason for that would be that we're not going to let the insurance companies take a chance and violate their duty. And if it turns out that nobody can prove proximate cause, then the insurance company would be off the hook. It's a prophylactic rule.
What duty, called AIC, you're basically saying that the attorney for AAIC should have, gone directly to what was the insurance company before that?
St. Paul. St. Paul was the primary. Yes, sir.
St. Paul's attorney. Now, I'm a little confused about the detectives insisting on a certain lawyer, but I assume St. Paul approved that lawyer and paid it.
As far as we know.
Okay, so what you're saying is somebody, I assume the lawyer for AIC, should have gone to that lawyer and told him, hey, you got a lot of problems. You know, you've got this internal conflict, and maybe he would have told you, yeah, well, we already cleared that up with the judge. I don't know what he would have said. But intervening, saying they ought to hire their own attorneys? What's he supposed to intervene and say?
What? And it's not.
It's got to be pre-verdict. Can't wait till after the punitive damages are all up there. Now there's got some kind of a duty, do they?
I would argue they do, because they still had a right to counsel. Our first point is not that AAIC's attorney needs to communicate with St. Paul's attorney. AAIC needs to do what every insurance company does with its insureds. In this case, AAIC sent letters directly to the insureds. I don't think it was all of them, telling them about some of the problems, but not all of them. What AAIC should have done under Illinois law is send a letter to the insurers, to the detectives, and to Will County, saying there's a potential conflict here because the detectives are each pointing the finger at each other, and there's a potential conflict here because of the compensatory versus punitive issue, which under Murphy versus Urso and Doe and Mobile all get them independent counsel, and tell them, the insureds, the detectives, you have a right to your own lawyer, each one of you, and someone will pay for it. Nobody ever told them that. As a matter of fact, St. Paul told them exactly to the contrary. So that's what should have been done. And it's the same thing that St. Paul had a duty to do. And our point is there's no difference between the duty a primary owes to the insured or the excess owes to the insured. Why don't they all have the same duty? Nobody suggested it's burdensome. And in this particular case, AAIC was well aware of it because of their initial involvement in the case at Gray Lake and attending the trial. As to the question of post-verdict, the same duty should exist post-verdict, because settlement could have occurred post-verdict. That's a separate question. And the counsel still had a right, the detective still had a right to their independent counsel after the verdict, just like they did before the verdict. If I have a right to my own lawyer and somebody has to pay for him or her before the verdict, I must have the same right after verdict. After verdict, AAIC took clear control because St. Paul was out of the picture. They actually paid their policy. Why would not AAIC at that point have a duty to say, well, now we're surely in charge. Those lawyers get to have their own lawyer take the appeal.
What point did they pay policy limits? What point did they do that?
St. Paul tendered its limits to AAIC before the verdict. St. Paul paid its policy limits to Mr. Fox after the verdict, I think in 2008. And then the appeal took place after that. The district court judge got it wrong. For some reason, the district court judge thought that St. Paul did not pay its policy until after the appeal was over, and it's just clearly wrong.
Well, but you said something about tendering before the verdict.
What did they do?
They're willing to pay. Obviously, they have a duty to defend, but they're going to pay into court $1 million.
It's the same in almost every case where you have a primary policy and an excess policy. At some point, the demand is more than the primary policy, but the primary policy issuer, in this case St. Paul, tenders its policy to the next layer of excess insurance and says, here, we're giving up on our policy. The ball is in your court. AAIC said, well, we still didn't have control of the defense of the case, but our point was simply, yes, but now you had the St. Paul policy, you had $1 million, and you had $5 million. It was up to you, AAIC, to tell St. Paul, okay, you've tendered yours, ours is now in play, you now have $6 million to work with, negotiate a settlement.
So they should have come then before the verdict.
Exactly.
And then maybe before trial, I don't know. But going in and looking at it and said, all right, look, we'll pony up X dollars over that in order to settle the case, or something like that.
Yes, sir. Okay. And that would have, it turns out that would have been within the demand from the plaintiff.
What was the demand? Or if you know,
I believe it was $6 million or just under $6 million.
Okay, so $6 million would have just worked out just right.
Just
that
exactly.
Is that why they dismissed the next level up?
There wasn't
bad faith there, at least.
Essex was not part of all of this. Essex didn't attend the trial. They have a different policy, and I don't think we're ever going to get into their money. They just didn't belong in the case, it turns out.
Just tell me this real quickly. Is the defendant correct that Mr. Fox has abandoned his estoppel and ratification claims on appeal? So, in other words, are we simply addressing the conflicts of interest and the refusal to settle at this point?
I, I always hate to agree that I've abandoned anything, because I think the ratification, although it's a separate count in the complaint, really is part of the other count. So, yes, those counts are out of the picture to the extent that ratification may be an issue in terms of whether AAIC is responsible for having a duty or saying something. That might be a separate question, but I'm not sure that that's a good answer. I'm not sure there is a good answer to that. We were trying to limit the issues on appeal, frankly.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hey. Good morning, Mr. Pates.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Let me just respond immediately to Your Honor's question. This absolutely is an end run around the punitive damage public policy in Illinois and the exclusion in my client's policy. We said that and told this Court that in the first paragraph of the summary of our argument. If I can respond briefly to the pre-trial settlement discussions, number one, Mr. Rathsack was not there, but more importantly, Your Honors, we were in the Seventh Circuit at the time because of an interlocutory appeal of the denial of summary judgment with respect to some of the Section 1983 claims. Those discussions were confidential. I'm a little troubled by the fact that there was even a discussion of them by counsel here, because we all signed something saying they were confidential, and frankly, his reference to them is incorrect. So I just wanted to address that. I think
The district court seems to have relied on a mistaken belief that AAIC never controlled the defense, when in fact AAIC did control the appeal for the defense. I mean, does AAIC deny that it controlled the defense during the appeal?
No, it was a function of timing, Your Honor. In the middle of post-trial motions and in the appellate process, there was a settlement with one of the remaining defendants that exhausted the limits. No, with St. Paul.
I'm sorry.
That exhausted the limits of their policy, which at that point in time contractually imposed a duty to defend on our client. That was after the covenant not to execute has been signed with respect to the defendants, and the state court action that had then been filed by the Foxes to attempt to recover under that. During the appellate process, our client was in fact controlling the defense in the sense of assisting with original counsel. We were paying for both.
So, in other words, you paid for appellate counsel once St. Paul tendered the policy limits to the plaintiffs?
No, not when they tendered. Tender does not create any duty under Illinois law for an excess insurer to get involved. A primary insurer can't just abandon their duty to defend by telling someone they'll pay their limits someday if someone will take them. They have a responsibility and the only obligation to defend an insurer until they've paid their limits. And conversely, with respect to my client's policy that's in the record, we have no defense obligations until there is exhaustion by payment of loss of the limit of the underlying policy. So that occurred, as Your Honor pointed out, in the course of post-trial and appellate practice that was going on, but we did not take over until after the covenant to execute or not to execute against the defendants individually, the detectives individually, was signed. And at that point in time, they then had their own lawyer that negotiated the subsequent release that avoided any responsibility that they had. And in fact, they told defense counsel to abandon any appeal
of the punitive. They are the detectives?
They being the detectives, Your Honor. Correct.
Help.
Well, there's a little bit of a commingling of issues that are floating around here that perhaps I can help this court clear up, because frankly, there are three issues as we tried to explain it in our brief.
Okay, I want to hear those desperately, but before I do, because I'm so afraid I'm going to forget, do you have an opinion about certifying to the Illinois Supreme Court the question regarding the duties of a secondary insurer prior to exhaustion of the primary?
I don't believe there's any need to, Your Honor. Every issue in this case that's before this court has been resolved in my client's favor by this court, by the Illinois Supreme Court, and by Illinois appellate courts. So there is nothing novel here. There's nothing new here. This is a nice try to get around the Illinois public policy that prohibits insurance coverage for punitive damages. That's what this case is all about. So if I can address the three issues very briefly, because I think they're easy for this court to resolve. The first is what we call the insurance conflict. In other words, when there are covered and uncovered claims in a lawsuit against an insured, does it have the right to separate counsel because the insurance company may control the way the case is defended so that the covered claims somehow don't get paid and the non-covered claims would. That's a responsibility. That's what we call the Peppers Doctrine, the Peppers decision. They hire Peppers Counsel. That's sort of the name we give to that. And in that situation, they get counsel to protect their interests. But the idea is they should have their own lawyer, not the excess insurer controlling defense. My client wasn't controlling the defense. We had nothing to do with the defense. We're an excess insurer. We had no obligation to defend. There is no insurance conflict as to my client because we did not have any control over the defense. We couldn't steer it one way or the other. We had no say in the defense of the case. So we're not responsible for any Peppers conflict. That's the responsibility, if there is an obligation, to have independent counsel for the primary insurer to do that. But, in fact, as we pointed out in our briefs, that's what happened anyways. They had their own lawyers. Will County hired someone to represent him, and St. Paul paid for him. That's why St. Paul had to intervene in the trial court so they could see pleadings in the case, get deposition transcripts, and even know what was going on. So the insurance conflict argument is simply a false issue. My client was an excess insurer with no obligation to be involved. As to this idea that somehow there should have been separate lawyers in the case and separate lawyers representing each of the different detectives, well, again, we're not controlling the defense. That's not our responsibility. What if St. Paul felt there should be five lawyers and we felt there should be three, Essex felt there should be two? What are we going to do? We're going to have chaos in terms of the defense of the case. And the reality is that's the lawyer's decision. The lawyer that's represented, that's chosen by St. Paul, I'm sorry, that's chosen by the insured, paid for by St. Paul, decide on a strategy. They decided that for whatever reason, all for one and one for all was a better way to defend the case. But that's the lawyer's decision. Insurance companies don't practice law. We don't drill down into a case and have an insurance claims person, a professional insurance person, but not a lawyer, making decisions about how to defend a case, how many lawyers should be involved, should people have a different strategy. I mean, that's the unauthorized practice of law, frankly, insofar as an insurance company would be concerned.
Was there a lawyer involved at the time that I don't know, attended the trial or did anything?
There were different involved. It would come as no surprise, and it wasn't in this case, Your Honor, that if for different witnesses and for different parts of the case, there was someone from Essex there, a claims person at one point. I sat in to watch a little bit of the trial because I was interested in seeing how certain witnesses performed so I could report back to my client. But in that sense, I, as a lawyer, was sitting in the back watching, observing. We weren't involved. We had no right to be involved. We hadn't filed appearances. We weren't involved in the defense, and we had no contractual responsibility to participate in the defense.
An umbrella, at least the way I've always understood it, it's been a long time ago, but the umbrella would come in and say, hey, primary, you better make a really good faith offer here. Otherwise, we're going to claim that, or they'll claim, let's just say that they didn't offer anything or something, rather. Says no liability. And then for some reason, the jury awards over $1 million and it hits the umbrella. The umbrella, as I used to understand it, is that you go in and converse and find out and make sure they're going to make a good faith offer so you don't get stuck. Now, beyond that, is there anything else?
No, well, Your Honor, this is a great segue into the third issue here, the duty to settle issue. And remember, this so-called, I don't know if you want to call it a contract remedy or a tort remedy with respect to the duty to settle, but it only is ripe, it only arises if there is a verdict for insurance-covered damages in excess of the insurance coverage. In this case, from day one, there was never a verdict in excess of the policy limits, the combined limits of the three policies, which was $11 million. And in fact, as we know, at the end of the day, the covered damages were about $5 million or $6 million of compensatory damages and some Section 1983 attorney's fees that was into the Essex layer of insurance. But insurance companies have the right all the time to decide, yes, there's exposure here. Yes, there's a likelihood of a verdict against their insureds. But if it's within the range of the insurance coverage And they're certainly permitted to let cases go to trial and to make an evaluation as to whether or not they think, notwithstanding the fact that maybe it's going to be more than $1 million, maybe it's going to get into my client's limits or my client's $5 million layer, we can still take the case to trial. And here, there's no damages to the detectives. The entire verdict for covered damages was within the limits of the insurance policies and was paid in full. There is no cause of action for bad faith failure to settle when there's no damages.
No, those damages were trimmed down a fair amount.
The compensatory and the punitives were both trimmed down in the course of post-trial motions and in this court in the subsequent appeal.
Down to where they got within that $6 million ceiling.
Well, but it's not $6 million, Ron. It's $11 million because those are all covered. Essex sits above us and has $5 million. There was a tower, shall we say, of $11 million of insurance, and the verdict was always for covered damages, compensatory.
You mean above the Essex, you mean, yeah.
Well, Essex was above us, Your Honor, correct. So in other words, with this whole sort of idea of bad faith failure, instead of just a red herring, that was always within limits. It was always paid. It was paid from day one. There was never any issue that my client or Essex, if necessary. In fact, Essex did, in fact, pay. The record will show some of the attorney's fees because my client's limit was paid in full. We did everything we were supposed to do. We paid $5 million, which was our policy limit for covered compensatory damages. We paid some pre- and post-judgment interest. We paid a portion of attorney's fees. We paid costs that were imposed upon the Will County defendants in the case. We did everything right. We didn't do anything wrong. We did exactly what we were contractually required to do in this case.
Well, somehow or other, they're trying to come up with a scheme, or whatever you want to call it, to go above whatever that and somehow get into what was labeled punitive, but there's some sort of a different type of a claim, and I'm not sure I understand it, but you probably know. What is the claim?
Well, in our view, Your Honor, it's not a claim because we don't have any obligation to provide coverage for punitive damages. And let's just, you know, talk.
Is there some other abuse or something that at least you focus on that says this is not, you're not talking about punitive, you're talking about somehow out of a breach or something that the insurance company should have done that would have made a difference, therefore this comes outside the policy?
No, there's nothing. We did that. Number one, we had no duty to defend. We had no duty to interfere in whether they had one lawyer, six lawyers, or 10 lawyers. We were available to pay and did pay the compensatory damage award. All of the Illinois law, you start with this court in the Iowa Physicians case, the idea of the duty of settlement is to protect the bargain for insurance coverage, not extend it. They got their bargain. We paid $5 million. And Kramer, the Illinois Supreme Court, said that this tort duty of good faith is used as a construction aid in determining the intent of the contracting parties. It ensures the parties don't do anything that will destroy the other party's right to receive the benefit of the contract. They got the benefit of the contract. They got $5 million plus our full limit. In the Central Illinois case, the court said the duty to settle does not obligate the insurer to perform the impossible by offering more than called for by its policy. Again, we paid our full $5 million limit. In the American Family case, as recently as 2 years ago, 2011, the Illinois Appellate Court said an insurer has a duty to act in good faith in responding to settlement offers, but that duty only exists when there's coverage under the policy. That's our point. We don't cover punitive damages. We did everything we were contractually required to do. We took over the defense when the primary insurer settled. That defense resulted in a reduction of compensatory damages. It resulted in a reduction of the punitive damages. And at the end of the day, when the case was over, we paid our full limit and more. We did everything we were contractually obligated to do. We did not breach any duty. And we asked that this court affirm the dismissal of the complaint. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to give you 2 more minutes.
Thank you. 2 points. 3 points. The question of certifying the question to the Illinois Supreme Court seems reasonable to me because I think everybody's agreed there is no law on point in Illinois that specifies what duty an excess carrier has in this particular fact situation. Counsel told the court that they did everything they have to do. They paid their policy limit. But that's not the point. The question here and what the complaint alleges, and it turns upon whether they had a duty to inform the insureds before the verdict and after the verdict of their separate rights. We're not trying to that's what happened. If the AAIC breached its duty to its insureds to tell them those things, then they're liable for whatever damages result, and those damages in this case include a verdict that included punitive damages.
But that would not be punitive damage. You wouldn't label those as punitive damages.
Not at all.
It's a separate claim.
Once the insured is liable for all those damages, and under Illinois law, if the insurer breached its bad faith, it becomes liable for those damages. It doesn't matter what the origin of those damages are. The insureds here were damaged because the case wasn't settled and because they didn't have independent counsel. That's what led to the punitive damages. That's our allegation. So the AAIC, by its breach, caused the insureds to have a huge punitive case against them rather than having this case settled within the policy limits and they go home. That's the damage. To the insureds, they just have a judgment against them. We just want to collect that judgment. And that our ability to collect is based on Latingham and Kramer and all the history of Illinois cases that let you do exactly that. It's a bright line rule in Illinois. Once the insurance company breaches its duty, it has to pay whatever damages were incurred. And the damages being in excess of the policy. I'm sorry.
Can you just tell me this? When you add everything together, what are the amounts that Mr. and Mrs. Fox received?
I'm sorry. I actually don't know the math, Your Honor. They received all their compensatory damages. The only part of the verdict for which the insureds are liable is the punitive that this court affirmed. I believe it's about $3.5 million, and that's what the insureds owed us. And that's what the insured say. We wouldn't have owed Mr. Fox those but for AAIC's failure to do what it was supposed to do.
Okay, well, thank you both. The case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.